loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the news of the day. First, the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland has begun, although controversy is hovering over the meeting in light of President Trump's America First trade policy and his recent comments about poor countries. Next, the Trump administration has slashed aid to UNRWA, the United Nations agency that assists Palestinian refugees, a move that experts in the region say will cause life-threatening conditions. Then, it appears that there will only be one candidate for president of Egypt in that country's upcoming elections, and that's military dictator Abdel Fattah al-Sisi. All other candidates have been systematically thrown out of the race or removed from the ballot, and one former Sisi supporter, himself a general, was arrested yesterday. And then a court in Brazil has upheld the conviction and 9.5-year prison sentence of former President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva on charges of corruption and bribery, upending that country's presidential race, which Lula leads widely in the polls. Finally, the United Nations is hosting in Vienna what it calls the last hope for peace in Syria. Representatives of both the Syrian government and the opposition will attend today. That's all starting now on Loud and Clear. But first, we turn to the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland. That conference has begun, although controversy is hovering over the meeting in light of President Trump's America First trade policy and his recent comments about poor countries. We're joined from London by Steve Keen, the author of Debunking Economics and the world's first crowdfunded economist. You can check out his work at patreon.com/Prof. Steve Keen. Steve, thanks for joining us.
Glad to be here.
So many issues to talk about related to Davos in so little time. In the U.S., press, it's all about the America First trade policy. It's all about sanctions. And then really, nobody's touching, at least in the States, nobody's touching on the issue with the Palestinians and the Trump administration's decision to cut off humanitarian aid. There's also no talk about Turkish President Erdogan and a very fiery speech by the Greek Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras, warning the Turks to do something about migration. Tell us your thoughts on Davos and how things have gone on this first day.
Well, my feeling about Davos is a bit similar to yours, just saying all the things they aren't discussing. It's a bit like there's an elephant in the room, let's not talk about the elephant. And the elephant for me is, I think the general mood at Davos now is that, thank God the financial crisis is 10 years behind us. Thank God we're returning to normality. The only abnormal stuff we have to worry about is a couple of weird dictators off to our right in Turkey and a madman off to our left in America. And what they're leaving out of the situation is that the recovery they're seeing is from a period of interest rates being up to 5% below what they were before the crisis hit, and a period of central bank spending of, in America's case, up to 6% of GDP every year buying financial assets. And they think, okay, we can stop doing both of those. We can put rates up, we can end QE, and now we can ask the world economy to go run a marathon at world record time. Guys, you've got an economy coming out of intensive care, and you think it's actually ready for a robust future. So I think that I'd mark Davos as the conference of delusion this year.
I think you're probably right. Should we expect any kind of international agreements or new international policies, whether it's related to trade or migration or anything else? Or is this just an opportunity for heads of state to get together and have some chit-chat?
Well, it's mainly chit-chat. I mean, the thing is, the chit-chat, it's a question of whether they're a chit-chat in panic mode or chit-chat in relaxed mode. And of course, when they're panicking, it's after a crisis. When they're relaxed, it's before a crisis. I think they'll be chit-chat in a relaxed mode, but frustrated by Trump, because he goes against all the usual stuff about how free trade deals are the best thing since sliced bread. He'll be going backwards about that. He'll be pushing back against migration. So it'll be a fairly frustrating conference in that sense, as they often are, but with a sense of optimism about the future. Now, I think that optimism is justified for about a year or so. So I'm actually more interested in Davos 2019 than I'm Davos 2018.
You know, when you look at the different titles of the World Economic Forum in Davos, it's kind of funny. I mean, it is funny. And that's why Steve Keen has shunned Davos this year. This year, the theme is creating a shared future in a fractured world. Of course, these are like the billionaires, the elites, and the politicians who are, you know, functioning more or less as their servants. When you go back to the 2007 and the 2008, when the world global economic contraction caused by the greed and criminal conduct of the biggest banks, both on Wall Street and elsewhere, the title that year in Davos was The Power of Collaborative Innovation. I mean, really? Of course, in 2009, there was a reference to the recession and depression they caused, and that was called, the theme then was Shaping the Post-Crisis World. And then the next year, Improve the State of the World, Rethink, Redesign, Rebuild. The next year, Shared Norms for the New Reality. All of these platitudes. The fact of the matter is, the three richest individuals in the United States have the combined wealth of almost half the country. And those same levels of inequality, those same levels of gross redistribution of wealth from the bottom or the middle to the top. I mean, that's the real dominant factor or feature of the global economy right now. And yet you have the corporate-owned media, again, the corporations that own the media that then talk about Davos as if it's this sort of sagat, the meeting of all this economic and global sage elements in the world are going to talk about how to reshape the world. Yes, it's a publicity stunt. Does it have any sort of import beyond that, beyond just celebrating the already very, very rich and putting them in sort of the position of being on the throne of the world economy?
No, I don't think it does. I mean, they only have anything significant coming out of Davos after there's been a complete shock to their expectations, the system falling over when they thought it was going to do very well in 2007, 2008, for example. Then the subsequent Davos might actually lead to some significant stuff because they are no longer trying to spin the world. They're trying to grab their own, get themselves back on solid ground again. And what's happened in the last decade, of course, is they've been immense beneficiaries of central banks trying to prop up the economy by propping up the financial sector and dramatically increasing the level of inequality that was one of the side effects of the financial crisis in the first place. So now they're thinking they can reverse all that. And that's why I think 2019 will be more interesting than 2018, because as the central banks start pulling out of QE and they start putting up interest rates in the belief their economies have returned to normality, then those economies will start falling over again. So I think I might accept the invitation to Davos 2019, but I couldn't be bothered with freezing my balls up in Switzerland in 2018.
Yeah, Donald Trump tweeted about Davos, John Kiriakou.
Yes, he did.
He's coming to tell the global elite that America is great.
Yes.
That's
yes.
It. Who would have thought?
I laughed when I saw that tweet. And you know, I'm looking at a piece too in Time Magazine, which concludes that whereby a year ago, the Europeans and these elites who go to Davos every year were intrigued by Donald Trump. This year, they just don't really care. They don't take him seriously. They think that he's weakening the United States. And so by extension, he's strengthening the Europeans. And so they're just sort of dismissive of him.
Wait a second. I don't want to be devil's advocate, but when you listen to his tweet, we'll soon be heading to Davos, Switzerland to tell the world how great America is and is doing. Our economy is now booming, and with all I am doing, it will only get better. Our country is finally winning, all caps, again, exclamation point. I mean, they also have to just be laughing their butts off. Go ahead, Steve Keen.
Well, if you're actually winning, you don't need to tell anybody. It's the Roger Federer attitude to victory rather than the Donald Trump attitude, where your insecurities are why you're shouting so loudly. So again, I think this particular year, he is going to be able to brag because there will be an unintentional large fiscal stimulus for the economy, courtesy of those tax cuts, before they start cutting back on Social Security to allegedly pay for them. So the economy will boom out of that. The interest rate rises by the Federal Reserve won't quite cause people to go into deleveraging yet, but it'll start getting ahead of momentum up. And the stock market won't necessarily fall over straight away as they start cutting back on QE, because people are now pouring their own money in there, partly compensating QE going in the opposite direction. But they should all bite by 2019. And of course, that's pretty bad time if you want to get reelected in 2020.
Indeed. And the Economist Intelligence Unit is predicting a recession in the United States by 2020, just in time for the next presidential election. With that, we're going to have to end it. We were joined from London by Steve Keen, the author of Debunking Economics and the world's first crowdfunded economist. You can read his work at patreon.com/Prof. Steve Keen, K-E-E-N. Please stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We will be right back after this.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
The Trump administration has slashed aid to UNRWA, the United Nations agency that assists Palestinian refugees, a move that experts in the region say will cause life-threatening conditions. We are joined from Washington, D.C. by Anne Wright. She's a retired U.S. Army colonel and former U.S. State Department official in Afghanistan who resigned in protest of the invasion of Iraq and who became an anti-war activist. Anne, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, John and Brian.
And commentators in the media said when President Trump first said he was going to cut aid to the Palestinians that if he cut aid directly to the Palestinians, it was really no big deal because there really wasn't that much in the way of aid. But if he cut UNRWA funding, that was a very big deal. So now we're looking at a cut from $125 million to $65 million. And people are saying that where this is going to hurt is with clean water, with medical care in the refugee camps, sewage, medicine, etc. Tell us your thoughts.
Well, I've been to Gaza and the West Bank and to refugee camps in Jordan and Lebanon. And yes, indeed, it's going to hurt a lot. It's going to hurt a lot of people. In Gaza in particular, where over half the population lives in what is still determined to be refugee camps. Here it is 60 years later. But they are refugees. They had to flee, and they ended up getting into Gaza to save their lives from the Israelis that were pushing them out of their Palestinian villages. And at the same time, called the Nakba, hundreds of thousands of refugees fled all over the region to include camps that are still in Lebanon, still in Jordan, and still in the West Bank. So there are millions of Palestinians that are affected by this cut, this brutal, inhumane, nasty Trump administration cut to UN funds that actually keep these camps going.
I've been to the Rafah refugee camp when I was on assignment to the State Department. I was a human rights officer. And I can tell you that even with funding, even with $125 million from the U.S. government, these are really, truly grim places. These are not places where you want to raise a family, for example. And what we have is generations of Palestinians living their entire lifetimes in these camps. Now, with this funding cut, we're looking at a potential humanitarian disaster.
Well, it surely is true. Living conditions are very sparse. There are lots of people living in very small areas. I mean, 2 million people in Gaza in an area that is 25 miles long, 5 miles wide. It's one of the most densely populated areas in the world. And it is one of the reasons that you have seen Palestinians really moving all over the area, those that can get out and that can get jobs in other places. It's usually the Palestinians that have been doing all sorts of work for the wealthier countries in the Arab world, whether they be the Emirates, whether they be in Kuwait. I mean, you look at who actually does the work, both construction work and educational work and accounting work. It will be Palestinians that are doing that. So it's criminal that what the U.S. is doing for those Palestinians that are left in these camps that don't have the ability to travel to get out of them.
Let's just review, Anne, if you would, for the audience. Why is the Trump administration and the State Department doing this?
Well, let's see. I think it's because of the outrage that the Palestinians and many in the Arab world have had over the decision of the Trump administration to designate the new embassy location in Israel to Jerusalem. The outrage that poured into the Arab streets, the Palestinian streets, I think embarrassed greatly the Trump administration. And so they are retaliating with this cut in funds to the UN mission, to the Palestinians.
Yeah, and Trump had said, now that Jerusalem's off the table, because right. he took it off the table, even though it's been a historic center in the Arab world and of the Muslim faith for so long, he's taken it off. He said, I think, okay, now let's have peace negotiations. We've right. just given away a big part of your territory.
Right. He said, since it's off the table, there's no reason to fight over other issues.
And then the Palestinians said, no, wait, we're not going to sort of put our own stamp of approval on the recognition of Jerusalem, of all places. The third holiest shrine in Islam is in Jerusalem, a historic Arab city. We're not going to say yes to that as the starting point for, quote, peace negotiations. And so he said, okay, guess what? Then we're going to starve your children. We're going to make sure they can't get medicine. We're going to make sure that they can't drink drinkable water. We're going to make sure that the sewage system doesn't really work. So it really is, I mean, by my view of things, this is a crime against humanity. Let's just call it what it is. It's a crime against humanity. It falls within the broader scope of war crimes. Again, punishing, carrying out collective punishment against a people, and most importantly, against the most vulnerable sectors of a people. That would be the very, very young and the very, very old, because the Trump administration didn't like their failure to acquiesce, to kowtow to him.
Yeah. So, Anne, what happens next? Are there other countries that can make up this this $60 million shortfall, this cut? We know that the Saudis, the Emiratis, the Kuwaitis don't care one whit about the Palestinians. But what about the Europeans? Do you think they're willing to step up?
Well, I certainly hope so. And they have been supportive of UNRWA. It's not just the United States that's been giving money for the Palestinian refugee situation over the many, many years. The Europeans have contributed, and I would anticipate that they will. I hope they'll pick up the slack, because they certainly have not agreed with the Trump administration on moving the embassy to Jerusalem. There's been a big outcry in European capitals saying this totally undermines the peace process. It is totally wrong, and they don't agree with it at all. So I would hope that they will pick up some of the slack. But, you know, some of the other things that we will be doing to bring attention to what is happening there, the enormous military threat that Israel has on Gaza and in the West Bank, the massive military strikes in 2008 and 9, 2012, 2014, still the blockade of Gaza, the naval and land blockade, and in fact, we'll be having another Gaza flotilla. We're going to be sending boats filled with internationals to highlight to the world the inhumane conditions that the Israelis have and this illegal blockade that still continues, that means that there are no commercial goods that can get in unless the Israelis say they can by land. So we'll be sailing again, and we'll keep sailing till Palestine is free.
When is that trip going to take place, Anne?
It'll be in the summer. We haven't disclosed the dates yet, but we already have purchased a boat, and there are already two boats purchased. We'll probably have a couple of more of them, and we would love to have the help. We've purchased on credit, I should say, so we're still paying for these boats, and would really appreciate if you just Google 2018 Gaza flotilla. We'd appreciate all the help.
We're speaking with Anne Wright, and Anne, I understand that you just came back from Gothenburg, Sweden, where there was, I think, the International Steering Committee for the upcoming Gaza Freedom Flotilla took place. Is that right? And secondly, how big of an effort is this?
Well, yes, I just got back into Washington last night from Sweden, and our international coalition meeting of 10 countries and one other international organization met in Gothenburg to continue our plans for the flotilla. This will be the 10th year, really. Starting in 2008 is when the international community started sending boats to break the blockade. And we've had boats that have gone virtually every year since, and we will continue to do this. It is a very important mission for those who support the Palestinians.
And you've been involved in previous flotillas as well, and the Israeli government has come down very hard on these peace activists, you and your colleagues. Can you tell our listeners about some of your previous experiences?
Surely. I was on the 2010 flotilla in which the Israelis executed nine Turkish citizens and one American Turkish young 17-year-old boy, shot him point-blank range, wounded 50 other people on one boat, and then on the other six in the flotilla boarded the boats and assaulted people on each one of the boats. They got rightfully a lot of international condemnation, of course not from the United States, but other countries really came down hard on them. You're taken to prison. You're taken to Israel against your will. You're arrested, put in prison, and then deported. And then the Israelis steal your boats. So we've had court cases in Israeli courts to try to get compensation or the boats back. And it's, you know, seldom do we win, but it reminds the Israeli public that their government has stolen boats from internationals in international waters.
Well, this is certainly an issue that we are going to come back to because of its import. We were joined from Washington, D.C. by Ann Wright. Ann is a retired U.S. Army colonel and former U.S. State Department official in Afghanistan who resigned in protest of the invasion of Iraq and became an anti-war and peace activist. And thanks so much for joining us. Please stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
It appears that there will be only one candidate for president of Egypt in that country's upcoming elections. That would be military dictator Abdel Fattah al-Sisi. All other candidates have been systematically thrown out of the race or removed from the ballot. And one former Sisi supporter, himself a general, was arrested yesterday. We're joined from Massachusetts by Vijay Prashad. He's the director of the Tricontinental Institute for Social Research and chief editor of Leftward Books. Vijay is also the author, most recently, of The Death of the Nation and the Future of the Arab Revolution and Red Star Over the Third World. He writes regularly for NewsClick in India, Frontline in India, The Hindu, also in India, Birgun in Turkey, and Alternet in the USA. Vijay, welcome back to the show.
Yes, thanks a lot. Thanks a lot, John.
So tell us about Egyptian elections. General Sisi is not even really making an effort to pretend that this is a democratic election. There have been potential candidates from all across the political spectrum in Egypt that have just been unceremoniously thrown off this ballot, including people who in the very recent past have been Sisi supporters. So what's going on over there?
Well, yes, so you're talking about Sami Anan, who was the former chief of staff and, in a sense, a Sisi supporter. He was arrested this week. And in fact, nobody, not even his children, know where he is. He has essentially vanished. So somebody close to Sisi has been arrested and has vanished. Ahmed Shafiq, who ran in 2012 against Mohamed Morsi, the candidate of the Islamists. Shafiq at the time was seen as the inheritor of the mantle of Hosni Mubarak, perhaps the military's candidate. In 2012, has withdrawn from the race. And most recently, Khalid Ali, who is a human rights lawyer, has left the race because he says people from his campaign have been intimidated, some have been arrested. So the entire spectrum from former military personnel, from a candidate of the elite in 2012, and a candidate of the human rights or civil society community, Khalid Ali, they've all been pushed out of the race in order to ensure that at the end of March, Mr. Sisi will come out as the victor. So, I mean, I don't know what you call this. It's, I suppose, a new form of democracy. They're still going to have an election. Let's not, forget that. So the shell, the shadow of democracy will be maintained, but there'll be only one candidate.
Well, frankly, this sounds very, very much like the half dozen elections we saw between 1979 and 2009, where Hosni Mubarak was reelected over and over and over again and was either the only person on the ballot or the only serious person on the ballot?
Well, you know, it's actually worse because in 2005, for instance, the election that preceded the Egyptian uprising that overthrew Hosni Mubarak from power, in that election in 2005, there was a candidate who was allowed to stand against Hosni Mubarak. Hosni Mubarak got about 88% of the vote, but Ayman Nur won, you know, I think something like 7 or 8% of the vote. Ayman Nur led the Al-Ghad party, and he was allowed to run. And of course, there was intimidation against his people as well, but he continued. In this election now, that was, I mentioned, in 2005. Now we are in 2018, after the uprising in Egypt that overthrew Mubarak, and you're at a situation where most likely there will be no candidate standing against Abdel Fattah el-Sisi.
Vijay, I was in Cairo at an anti-war conference in December 2013. I came as one of the representatives of the U.S. anti-war movement. It was a big conference. It was held in Cairo. It was allowed to take place by the Mubarak government. It was a coalition of organizations that at their root, at their core, one was the Muslim Brotherhood, and the second was essentially secular democratic socialists. At the end of the conference, where we all took a stance against the U.S. war drive in the Middle East, all the conference organizers were all arrested, and they had all expected to be arrested. But nonetheless, Mubarak allowed the conference to take place and then arrested the people who organized it. So there was this kind of appearance of democracy, but then it was a very tortured, narrow democracy since the organizers went to jail. And they went to jail for about 6 months, I think. What's the situation now in Egypt? Here, you know, today is the anniversary. Today is January 25th, the anniversary of the uprising in Tahrir Square, an important moment in the so-called Arab Spring, something that you've written extensively about, including your book. What's it like now in Egypt politically compared, say, to earlier eras, not just in the electoral field, but in the area of space for political organizing?
Well, you know, it should be said that Egypt, like Tunisia, for instance, has a very rich tradition of socialist politics. In fact, Tunisia, in the last couple of weeks, has seen a return to street politics, massive demonstrations on the street against the government, against the austerity regime put forward by the government. You know, the Workers' Party in Tunisia has played a very important role in maintaining and building the resistance to the government in that country. So, you know, as I said, Tunisia and Egypt have a very strong tradition of left politics, street politics, and so on. In Egypt, there are, of course, a range of left political parties that are, you know, the heirs, in a way, of the older tradition of Egyptian leftism that predate the coup by Gamal Abdel Nasser in 1952. You know, their basic slogans, which became the main slogan of Tahrir Square, was bread, freedom, and social justice. That was the slogan in Tahrir, and that historically has been the slogan of the Egyptian left. There has been, of course, some narrowing of the Egyptian left capacity that has come for two different reasons. One, the Egyptian left split quite decisively when the military led by Mr. Sisi overthrew President Morsi of the Muslim Brotherhood. Some sections of the Egyptian left supported the overthrow. For instance, the Socialist Popular Alliance Party supported the overthrow of Mr. Morsi by the military, and that's what brought Sisi to power. Other sections disagreed with that support. In fact, they said that despite their dislike of Mr. Sisi, of Mr. Morsi and the Muslim Brotherhood, and the dislike of the kind of agenda he was pushing, the way to defeat him isn't through a military coup. That section broke with the Socialist Popular Alliance and formed the Bread and Freedom Party. And the Bread and Freedom Party, you know, has a place in almost every part of Egypt. They've been trying to build their capacity not only in among slum dwellers in urban Cairo and Port Said and Alexandria, but also in rural Egypt, where peasant struggles have really deteriorated. Tahrir Square was not really an Egyptian uprising. It was an Egyptian urban uprising. The links between the city and the countryside were very weak, which is why it was hard to get the rank-and-file military people on the side of the rebellion. After all, they come from rural Egypt mainly, and their issues were not front and center of the 2011-2012 uprising in Egypt. So the point I'm making is that the left exists. Its space of operation has been narrowed, one, because I think it took very difficult decisions around what to do with the Muslim Brotherhood and Sisi, and secondly, because Sisi has run an extraordinarily suffocating government, which has prevented mass demonstrations, which has been arresting people, much of it outside the bright light of day. And the left has therefore been largely absent. This time, Khaled Ali came out, this human rights lawyer, as a candidate before he withdrew. But there was no real authentic candidate of the left, to come before the people. So the left is weak. There is some disillusionment. I think the enormous promise of the Tahrir uprising has not been, and its demise has not been fully digested. So there is defeatism, I think, in the ranks of the left. This is different from Tunisia, where there is not that kind of historic sense of defeat. They feel like their struggle is continuing.
You know, how interesting it is, Brian, you and I have been to Egypt many times over the years, over decades now. And it's so interesting to me that the left, which used to fit very nicely into the Arab nationalist movement, has kind of gone its own way, or maybe more specifically, it's the military that at one time had been allied with the left that has moved so much farther to the right, and at the same time has kind of pushed the left off into obscurity in Egypt. It's something that I think most analysts didn't expect to happen 20 years ago.
Yeah, go ahead, Vijay. About 90 seconds left.
Yeah, I mean, I'd just like to say very quickly that, the problem is that there is an internal debate in the Egyptian elite. One side of the elite, which is the more neoliberal side, where Mubarak's children, for instance, fit in perfectly. This side of the elite wants to pursue a kind of a globalization trajectory for their, accumulation to grow their wealth. The other side, where the military is squarely positioned, it wants to continue some sort of rent extraction, national democratic, system, because the military in Egypt has got its fingers in every part of domestic production, from the manufacturing of soap to having positions, even real estate, huge real estate. So this debate in the elite was reflected in the Tahrir aftermath, where the two sides of the elite were battling each other. And there was no role for the left here. I mean, that's the real tragedy, is the left does not have a historical project that it was able to articulate outside after Tahrir Square. It was suffocated by this debate between two flanks of the elite. And it appeared to the outside world as if this was some great transformation from below. But actually, it was also hijacked quickly in this debate between the elite.
Well, we'd like to thank Vijay Prashad, who joined us from Massachusetts. Vijay is the director of the Tricontinental Institute for Social Research, and he's chief editor of Leftward Books. He's also the author, most recently, of The Death of the Nation and the Future of the Arab Revolution, and also of Red Star Over the Third World. He writes regularly for NewsClick, Frontline, The Hindu, Birgun, and Alternet here in the USA. Please stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
A court in Brazil has upheld the conviction and 9.5-year prison sentence of former President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva on charges of corruption and bribery, upending that country's presidential race, which Lula leads widely in the polls. We're joined from Washington by Aline Piva. She is with the group Brazilian Expats for Democracy. And we're joined in the studio by Sputnik News analyst Walter Smolarek. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank Good to be here.
Aline, let me ask you a question. This sounds like just catastrophic news. In fact, this is not the end of the road for Lula. He has several different levels of appeals left. And as I said in the introduction, he leads widely in the polls. So what do you think we should expect to see in the coming months?
So, yes, but there's a little of legal controversy about what comes next. There are some people, some legal experts that say that he could actually be in jail by the end of next month. But yes, you said, there are some levels of of appeals that he can still go through. But one thing that is very important for us to understand is that what happened yesterday doesn't have anything to do with Lula's presidential campaign. In fact, today, the Workers' Party has just confirmed that he will actually be the party's candidate for the upcoming presidential elections. So he being convicted yesterday, his sentence being, upheld by this appeal court, does not mean that he cannot run. On the other hand, yes, this can, be potentially damaging for because he, there's a chance that he cannot assume the office if he actually wins the next presidential election.
And that's a question that we have. Brian and I were talking about this just between the two of us yesterday. We had a presidential candidate here in the United States a century ago, Eugene V. Debs, who ran for president on the Socialist Party from his prison cell and got something like 2 million votes. What would happen if Lula were to actually be incarcerated and still went forward as the Workers' Party nominee? What would happen if he won the election and he were still in prison?
That would be a historical moment for Brazil, because he actually is the only candidate that we have so far that has actual chances to win the presidential elections. He is the only person that now has the support throughout, he has been able to gain support, more and more support throughout the country. And what I think is happening is that the coup mongers, the people who staged this whole political turmoil that we are living now in Brazil, they are kind of in a dilemma. If they put Lula in jail, he's going to be kind of a martyr because, it's very clear that what is happening is a political persecution. There is no doubt about it. That is a botched case that they have against him. If they don't put him in jail, what is going to happen is that he's going to campaign and he's going to win. His candidacy has to be, formally put forward on August, and just after that is when the opposition can potentially try to take him out of the presidential campaign. But I don't think they have much option than, and in any ways they lose. Whatever happens to him, they will lose.
The Workers' Party has successively won one presidential election after another. Lula won twice. He was the founder. He was a trade unionist, a worker. He formed and helped form the Workers' Party of Brazil in the 1980s. By the early 2000s, had become the leading figure, not just for the Workers' Party, but of all politicians in Brazil. So he won, I think, twice. And then Dilma Rousseff, who was going to take his place as the next candidate, and she herself had a very pristine place in Brazilian history as a guerrilla fighting against the military coup d'etat that took power in 1964. She was expected perhaps maybe to lose, but she surprisingly won again in 2014. She had almost 52% of the vote. So then the opposition parties, the right-wing parties, sort of ganged up on Lula and took advantage of Brazil's ongoing and deep economic crisis, caused, I would say, not by the Workers' Party social democratic reforms, but the 2007-2008 worldwide Great Recession that was instigated not in Brazil, but at Wall Street. They took advantage of it and carried out what was, in essence, a legislative coup d'etat. They impeached her for corruption, even though she was not corrupt. The corrupt impeached her for corruption. That's actually what happened. And now you have Lula leading in the polls again. So the Workers' Party would win once again. But the conviction of Lula upheld now in the sentencing of Lula to 9.5 years in prison, it seems to me it completely upends any notion of real democracy in Brazil, because if you have the most popular party and the most popular candidate off to prison, clearly on the eve of an election so that the election won't take place, what are the people to do? In other words, they won't really trust in the electoral process. They will do something else. Aline, are they in the streets? Are people in the streets right now?
Yes, they are. This week has been, you know, it's beautiful how people are actually organized. And you said something really important. People are organized, of course, in solidarity with Lula, but people are organized against, you know, the undermining of democratic rule in Brazil. We have this is a trend that we have been seeing for quite some time now. You know, we had the coup, the unconstitutional impeachment against Dilma Rousseff. We have now Lula's trial. And they are instrumentalizing the rule of law in the country and undermining all the institutions. We don't have, you know, people. I think this is the lowest historical rate that we have in Brazil, that people doesn't have any faith on democratic institutions anymore. So we have people organized throughout the country and internationally. That's the international solidarity has been something quite, you know, quite amazing to see. And we keep fighting.
Let's ask Walter Smolarek a quick question here, a political news analyst. Walter, since the Monroe Doctrine, which was a while ago, a couple hundred years ago, there's almost nothing that happens anywhere in Latin America where the U.S. doesn't pay careful attention. And of course, as evidenced by the Monroe Doctrine, the United States feels institutionally that they, the U.S. government, should control Latin America. They're obviously paying attention to this carefully. Brazil is the largest country in Latin America. Leftist governments have been toppled or been riven with strife in the recent period. What's Washington's attitude towards this?
Yeah, I think they've completely accepted the coup government of Michel Temer, the soft coup government of Michel Temer, as the legitimate authority. I mean, they have meetings with them. They have meetings with their diplomats and representatives. I mean, compare that to the campaign against Venezuela, for instance, that's been waged by the Organization of American States. The OAS has, you know, a quote unquote democracy clause where if the democratic order of any of the member states are disrupted, then they can be suspended from the OAS on that basis. They applied that to Cuba. They applied that, you know, they made great efforts that were ultimately unsuccessful to apply that to Venezuela. But they haven't applied it to Brazil. They haven't applied it to Honduras, which is, you know, in some ways an even more blatant case of fraud. So I think that the double standard that the United States applies to the region when it comes to election results that they like and election results that they don't like is very striking, especially in this case.
You know, there's a little bit of a postscript to this too. In 2016, Brazil passed a law saying that anyone convicted of a crime had to be incarcerated during the course of the appeal. That has not been effectuated or implemented so far with Lula. But if the government wanted to really make trouble and to force this as a political issue, as Aline said, they could arrest him pretty much any time they wanted.
Yeah, Aline, we have about 90 seconds left. You get the last word.
Yes, that is true. I don't think they are going to do it so far, but yes, we need to be very attentive to what is happening right now, because Lula could be in jail at any time. But more than that, not only Lula, but the social movements, the grassroots movement in the country is being more criminalized than ever. So we need to be very, you know, in solidarity with Brazil right now.
Right. And I'm just looking at the New York Times. Lula, they're saying, looked drained, but sounded resilient when he addressed supporters in Sao Paulo on Wednesday night. Quote, he said, Mandela was sent to prison and then he came back and became president of South Africa. a horse sounding, Mr. Da Silva said. And of course, there's a lot of hallmarks here that are, well, it's not just about Brazil or just about Nelson Mandela in South Africa. When workers' organizations or grassroots organizations try to take power, they're almost always the victim of pushback by the powers that be, the real elites in society. I think that's what we're witnessing. But this game, this struggle, this is far, far from over.
And there are lessons here for other countries as well. We're going to have to leave it there. We were joined from Washington by Aline Piva. She's with the group Brazilian Expats for Democracy. And we were joined in the studio by Sputnik News analyst Walter Smolarek. Please stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back after this.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
The United Nations is hosting in Vienna what it calls the last hope for peace in Syria. Representatives of both the Syrian government and the opposition will attend today. We're joined from London by Shabir Rezvi. He is an economist and a political analyst. Thanks so much for joining us, Shabir.
Thank you.
Shabir, would you agree that this is the last chance for real peace in Syria?
It's being marketed as a last chance, but I don't think that is the case. Obviously, the previous rounds of Syrian peace talks, which took place in the Swiss city of Geneva, have failed to achieve any result that can be classified as tangible, essentially due to the opposition's insistence that Syrian government relinquish power. So if we move away from that paradigm that Assad shouldn't be in power, then perhaps we could get some tangible results. However, what you must remember is that over the previous few months, Russia, in parallel, together with Turkey and Iran, has been continuously holding talks in Astana and other places. And there is another set of talks scheduled to take place end of this month in Sochin. So I believe those parallel talks have actually resulted in areas where there's no conflict taking place. There are areas where hostilities have diminished. So I think whether Vienna talks will have any tangible results, but certainly the parallel talks under the auspices of, as I said, Russia, Iran, and Turkey are certainly bearing some fruits at this moment.
I'm looking at a piece in Al Jazeera from today. It says the Syrian government refused to hold even indirect talks, saying the opposition's demands for a removal of Assad constituted a precondition that infringed on the basic principles of the talks. This time in Vienna, the opposition moderated its tone, but not the substance of its requests. Do you think maybe that it was the tone that the Syrian government was objecting to? And even if the opposition is still demanding as a precondition the removal of Assad, the government would be willing to go forward and negotiate some of these other outstanding issues?
Well, it's not only the opposition, which, if I may use some colorful language that Mr. Trump tends to use, they have proved themselves to be imbeciles over the last 6-7 years of the crisis in Syria. What they have always wanted was the removal of a legitimately elected government in Damascus. And not only the opposition, but also, as the foreign ministry spokesman, Maria Zakharova, today said that the recent speech by the U.S. Secretary of State is really proof that Washington has hostile policies towards Syria. And also, it is very clear that what USA is trying to achieve, and the Washington consensus together, that they want to create a sort of Bantustan in Syria, where small enclaves are created, which really have no essence of sort of standing up for the rights of the Syrian people. If they're divided into tiny little countries, they really would have no power. And obviously, when that happens, then the main aim of regime change, which has been the echo chamber of the Washington consensus, would come into play. Hence, the desire of the opposition groups that are meeting in Vienna would also be fulfilled. So the ultimate aim, if you like, is not to have Assad in Damascus.
At the same time, we have Turkey's military offensive in the northern part of Syria. Again, looking at some other media reports, they say, this is one from Al Jazeera, in the meantime, the situation in the Kurdish-held area is also deteriorating. Turkey is conducting a military offensive against the Kurdish fighters in the Syrian enclave of Afrin with Moscow's agreement. I want to ask you about this because we've heard different reports on what the Russian position actually is here. Some of the observers who we've discussed have told us that the Syrian government, with the support of the Russians, went into Afrin and said to the Kurdish military units affiliated with the YPG that if they were prepared to raise the Syrian national flag, the Syrian army and other support, military support, presumably from Russia, would come to their aid against a possible Turkish offensive, and that the Kurds said no to that, and that as a consequence, Russia pulled back. Now, we don't know here in Washington, D.C., whether that's true or whether that's correct, whether it's accurate or not, or whether or not there's some other sort of geopolitical, sort of cold-blooded decision between Russia and Turkey, who are allies, at least at the Astana talks, and along with Iran, the guarantors of the Astana peace process. What's your take on that? What's going on in the north?
Well, of course, it's speculation on your part and my part at this moment, not being privy to exactly what's being sort of worked out in that part of Syria. But what is really clear is that Turkey is in a conundrum at this moment. Because initially, if you recall, Turkish territory was used to supply all and sundry ISIS fighters in Syria. Now that ISIS has been defeated, not because of Washington, as sometimes is being portrayed in the media, but really by the effective effort of Russia, Iran, and Hezbollah, if these three elements were not there, then ISIS would still be prospering in Syria. So now that Syria is almost free of ISIS elements, of course, there are certain parts which are still under control of ISIS. But what is happening is that Turkey is trying to protect Turkey in itself, if you like, from the spillover of what may happen if those ISIS elements come into Turkey. And I have quite often tried to draw a parallel as to what happened with Pakistan when the Taliban were used from the Pakistani territory by the support of the Saudi money and Washington sort of training of the Taliban at that time, that Pakistan paid a colossal price for it over the last 30 years. So it's potential that if the war is not contained in Syria, then it could have a spillover in Turkey. And I think that's what the Turkish ruling elite, and particularly Mr. Erdogan, is probably trying to reconcile, that it's better to have the war in Syria than for it to come home and create significant problem in Turkey itself.
I have to say that I'm struck by a recent comment by the Turkish president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan. He said very simply and very plainly, until the last terrorist is neutralized, this operation will continue. Not sure how that really plays into the whole narrative of peace or even justifies the term of the operation, which is Operation Olive Branch. But, you know, it makes me wonder if peace is really possible if you've got these talks going on and they don't include the Turks, the Russians, maybe even the Americans, that it relies just on the government and the opposition, when there are these outside forces, legal or not, that have involved themselves.
And just to add on, John, I'd like to ask Shabir, what really do you believe is the military objective now of Turkey, and will they will they push east of the Euphrates, because that's where the Americans are, and they're also working with the Kurds and obviously wanting to have their own sphere of influence. Go ahead. We just have a couple minutes left.
Okay. When Turkey talks about terrorist groups, obviously it's referring to the Kurds, who are defined as a terrorist group in Turkey. But I'm not very clear whether Turkey also refers to ISIS as terrorists. Just like Washington and my own government here in UK talks about terrorism, but continues or has in the past supported ISIS elements in Syria. So I think really Turkey, as I said, is in a conundrum as to where they want to move. But I think the problem lies, as you quite rightly said in your question, that if Russia, Iran, and Turkey are not involved in discussions taking place in Vienna, so I don't know how far those talks will go. Because really, at the end of the day, it's Russia and Iran who have their forces on the ground. They are actively trying to destroy ISIS, which they have to a significant degree sort of achieved that goal. But you have two pockets at this moment, one near the Turkish border in Afrin and the other east of Euphrates, which is still under the control of ISIS and other elements which are associated with ISIS. So we have a difficult situation in Syria, but I believe if there is to be an honest situation taken by Washington.
John, and I apologize to Shabir, I think we're completely out of time.
We are. We're out of time. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. You can also hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and Clear.
Love.